It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. On our shows, we talk about sleep and issues related to sleep. And today, we're going to be talking about narcolepsy and cataplexy, some interesting words that we'll define during the episode. We have a guest who is someone living with narcolepsy and cataplexy and is also a sleep advocate, and his name is Solomon Briggs. So, Solomon, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm excited to be here to share a bit of my story and talk perspective and advocacy.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I think, you know, a lot of people are probably wondering, what does the word narcolepsy mean and what does this strange word cataplexy mean? But as we get into that, would you mind giving us a little bit about your background? How did you first discover that these words applied to you? And just what was it like before you actually got a diagnosis?
That's a loaded question in that it took me 28 years before I discovered the term and then a few years to get the diagnosis. We'll talk about the difficulties of that path at a point, but background, I mean, I could spend the whole interview just going into that, but I, so 20 years old, I began experiencing this very particular occurrence that was very impactful, and it was cataplexy, but it took me another 8 years to ever figure that name out. As a child, I was dealing with instances where during tickling battles, in good fun, when I would be, you know, over beaten, you know, they'd be tickling my belly or my armpit somewhere sensitive, and I'd have these plethora of inner sensations, this flickering of muscles, wave-like rushing through my head and body sensations that became overwhelming. And during that, as I was trying to respond or tickle back, my arms would just be completely unliftable. They'd just be limp completely. And I was very tuned into it, but, you know, I'd say, oh, I can't lift my arms. I could roll my body. I could continue to laugh, but it was something I was very tuned into, and nobody ever really, they thought I was, or I don't know what they thought, but it was, you know, as though I was trying to just get out of, or making an excuse or something. Not even, it's hearing somebody say, oh, I can't lift my arms while they're laughing really hard. It's like, okay. But at 20 years old, at home in the comfort where I had my guards down, where I stayed at home with my mom and my stepfather going through college, and we'd always joked around and I cooked for them. But all of a sudden, I started having this muscular interference or muscular interruptions. I prefer to use that terminology than muscle weakness. Okay. As muscle weakness is more of a fatigue, and I think it's associated more with like sleepiness. But it quickly went from just the subtle, minimal, partial drooping, slacked hands, slouching of the upper torso, loss of eye contact during laughter, my facial expressions I noticed was like lost. I couldn't continue laughing externally while internally I was cracking up. And over a matter of weeks, maybe a month, it went from the minimal into the moderate and then to severe. And this is my range that I've come up with, which I'd come up with over those through my 20s as I was collapsing 5 to 25 times a week, if not on bad days, more than 5 times, like literally. Wow. Not so much was it. So I'm a skateboarder, give a little more background. I grew up as an athlete. I was doing like gymnastics at 2 or 3, but that didn't last long. I started playing soccer, probably at like 4 or 5 and was on traveling teams. I started skateboarding and doing Taekwondo at 8 years old, got my black belt at 12 or 13, and then I kind of stopped that. But I've always been an avid skateboarder. I started snowboarding around 17. I played ice hockey from about 11 on through high school, and still I'll play in an adult league now and then. Mm-hmm. But I think because of those activities, especially skateboarding, I mean, I wrote a book where I talk about how skateboarding couldn't have prepared me better for and or helped me adjust to living with severe cataplexy. And severe cataplexy, so to go back to the way it kind of came on for me, it was minimal, and then it became moderate. And what I describe as moderate is, say, having to lean against the wall because you're unstable. Your stability is affected. It can be also like a suddenly being frozen in an awkward position. I mean, standing, but just sort of frozen. Time will sort of slow. You'll disassociate, or at least for me, I disassociate from the external because I'm trying to internally stay composed and stay upright. Mm-hmm. And so then I want to say that if you battle and you try to overstrengthen that cataplexy, once it starts breaching into moderate, that act of trying to remain upright or composed literally becomes an act of fighting the cataplexy in another sense. And that amplifies and prolongs it potentially dramatically.
Wow.
Just like stress. I can go into all this a little later, or maybe I should just throw it out now. I have a very deep breakdown. I feel like there's a deeper layer level to cataplexy that really I've never even seen touched on in medical literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been deeply in it. I mean, I feel like I'm almost like a monk in terms of studying and meditating on this subject since I discovered the term, because it had impacted my life so dramatically. And I've had all the other symptoms my entire life, but it was the only normal that I knew. So like, you adapt, and subconsciously over time, your personality, your character, the traits, mannerisms, behavior, your mindset, even more psychologically, is all impacted by these symptoms in very deep, invisible though fierce manners. And I'll try to go back because I know I went off.
Well, let me ask this, because I want to make sure we get this all together. So you're talking about having cataplexy. You're talking about how it began for you. It sounds like the way you're describing it, you experience your muscles kind of losing muscle tone, and you're not having full control of your muscles. The two questions that I have that I think people would be curious about is, number one, when an incidence of cataplexy is coming on for you, what do you know ahead of time so that you can kind of prepare for it, is one question. And the second part of the question is, so we're hearing a lot about muscles. How is that related to sleep? Can you fill us in on those two?
Yeah, I'll try to go there. So to go back to my story, because I was actually sort of going there. It became moderate, and then I was having to lean against the wall. Say I was joking around with my parents, that was starting to happen a lot. Or other instances where I'd cooked food and was bringing a plate, and they'd smile, and I would end up I'd drop the plate because my hands, my muscles would just, you know, go slacked. But quickly that turned into severe. And severe in my breakdown involves a temporary complete muscle paralysis. That's, you know, part of the definition. Remaining fully conscious throughout. You can often see and also hear, although your eyes are sputtering, it's rapid eye movement. But some people close their eyes. And then for me, there was more of a melting or a quick sort of impact, not so much the instantaneous, although I've had plenty of those where it is like your knees buckle and you're basically a ragdoll just collapsing instantly to the ground. I remember I had somebody about 2 feet away from me, or maybe even a foot away from me, and it hit me so hard. It was just something super funny. And I actually took them out at the same time I hit their leg, and they went down with me.
Wow.
Yet it took me, normally for me, it was about 15 to 30 seconds that I was in this paralysis. Mm-hmm. And when it first began, I actually was battling and trying to overstrengthen it, really physically and mentally, because it is stimulation of emotion. Though, to go to another point that I go into, the common triggering is connected to emotional stimulation. And there's so many layers upon layers of how emotions work. I mean, we experience 400 plus emotions a day, but we aren't tuned into them. Though, the way that, sort of losing my focus.
So, I mean, the emotions leading to sort of this increase in trouble maintaining control over your muscles. So you're losing this muscle tone, right? You're losing that ability to control. And then it sounds like you literally fall down, like you collapse.
Yeah. So there was something there I was going to try to express, but basically when I say melting, and not exactly gradual, but as I'm a skateboarder, I have very good spatial awareness, and I learned to fall. I mean, I learned to like run and tumble in Taekwondo at a young age, and I would most of the times be able to get one arm down as I went down, so I could sort of control the impact.
Great.
And great. What to answer the question that you'd asked, if there's any sense going into it, a lot of times, most of the times, there absolutely was for me. And I think that that's something that gets missed, in that if you have strong cataplexy, and where I was going right now, I remember where I was going, was that with more severe cases, and there's a stat, less than 10%, under 5 to 7% of those with cataplexy are dealing with regular, frequently occurring, severe collapsing cataplexy over a long duration of time. I heard that at a Narcolepsy Network conference by doctor researchers in like 2017. And that's a very telling stat. Mm-hmm. But for my 20s, I was in that. I was collapsing a lot. But there, for me, when it first began, and going back even to the where I was battling it in those first real severe instances, where for me it was 2 or 3 minutes of going up and down and my body was like twitching. I mean, it probably looked like a seizure, which I have a whole history in all that, but that's too much. It did relate to how come I didn't seek medical help at the time, because I had had a pancreas surgery as an infant. Uh-huh. That was experimental. It was at Mayo Clinic. But so soon after those first really severe instances where I was battling it, it dawned on me that there were these exact distinct inner sensation flickering of muscles, like I described going back to my childhood when I was in tickling battles. So that was very peculiar, and so was how this was occurring. I mean, the severe cataplexy is one thing, but most people are living with minimal to moderate extents of it who have cataplexy. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, almost, I shouldn't say every interaction through my 20s, but like I was dealing with the drooping and the loss of my facial expression, and the difficulties in speech is a huge one. You know, it can be like a stutter, a slurring, a mumbling, very slow speech, having to stop, being unable to complete your sentence. But during all of the minimal and moderate, I at least experienced this inner flickering. And this, I think, is something that people don't tune into because it's part of experiencing joy and pleasure and emotion. You know, rolling on the floor laughing is a common terminology, and it's accepted, and it's not right. seen as anything unusual. Though, say somebody wins a award or the lottery, they'll have a sort of cataplexy reaction. But with people right. that live with really strong cataplexy, it can be somebody just randomly smiling at you. It can be being asked a question unexpectedly. It can be seeing some, you know, silliness occurring in your area. But it can be any sort of emotion also. Irritation and frustration. Mm-hmm. Stress is such a huge element in narcolepsy across all the symptoms in right. terms of influencing and impacting or escalating.
Mm-hmm.
So your second question, did I at all touch on that?
My second question was how this relates to sleep. But before we get to that, let me take a quick commercial break. We'll come back. We'll talk about how this relates to sleep. And then we'll also talk about how you got into advocacy. So we'll be right back with Solomon Briggs on Sleep Science Today. If you're having trouble sleeping and you need support, don't go it alone. Join us at our free online support group at sleepsupportgroup.com. Just put in your email address, sign up for the list, and you will be notified of all of our upcoming meetings. It's free, so why not try it out?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Solomon Briggs about narcolepsy and specifically cataplexy. And we've learned a lot about how muscle tone is involved and loss of muscle tone. But Solomon, what has this got to do with sleep?
Okay. And this will go into the advocacy stuff. So when I first discovered the term cataplexy, I did a search on Google of laughter in quotes and mm-hmm. capitalized and paralysis. And that brought me to an article about some runner who dealt with cataplexy, and the narcolepsy side of it to me was like so foreign, and like I don't have sleepiness. What is that? It doesn't really fit. It must be cataplexy without narcolepsy or something. Mm-hmm. And I immersed myself in medical literature. I got on to what were at the time the Narcolepsy Network message boards, which mm-hmm. were super valuable. That's where I had personal interactions online and really got the human experience side of it. And that's what my advocacy is really focused upon. I'm going to touch on something that's a huge topic. Meds, for me, I've not found a med that has actually benefited me at all. And I absolutely don't discourage against meds. I know I've met so many people that they're life-changing for. I absolutely think it's a important thing that everybody should try, and try until they find something if they can. But, you know, I've got so many sensitivities and allergies. The pancreas thing, I think, plays into it.
Right.
At 30 years old, right around when I got the diagnosis, I went gluten-free, dairy-free, I cut out common sugars, I stopped eating meats, and that may have had something to do with the regression of the cataplexy, because by 31, since 31, I'm 45 now, I've collapsed a time a year or maybe a time every 2 years. So I thankfully managed to regress it. But at the same time, the symptoms morphed and I began dealing with all the other symptoms much more gravely, though it also was, I had tuned in. So we'll get to the muscles in all of this, I think. The way that I see these symptoms are, each symptom is either a bracket and or a range with its own spectrum. Let's take brain fog. I made a image, and I'm going to just read through it. It's a tree. At the root of it are three elements, but basically brain fog, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cognitive difficulties and effects. At the root of cognition, you've got memory, thought, reasoning, and perception. As you go up the roots into the trunk, you've got alertness, consciousness, awareness, dissociation. This is just my way of putting together these terms. But then in the branches and the leaves, this is going to be a bit, you've got pattern recognition, cognitive function, understanding, senses, arousal, recognition, computation, imagination, sentience, perceptual, cognizant, excitatory, elaboration, sensory, reasoning, retrieval, acuity, remembrance, recollection, forgetful, intuition, response, concept formation, anticipation, generalization, knowledge, information processing, planning, projection, self-reflection, feedback, regulation, decision-making, encoding, evaluation, habituation, discernment, monitoring, rationality, thought, learning, inhibition, precision, concept, attention, analysis, operation, clarity, concentration, comprehension, focus, processing, categorization.
Oh,
so that is a tree of brain fog, right?
Right.
And brain fog overlaps with excessive daytime sleepiness, with disrupted nighttime sleep. There's the dissociation, which is part of all the symptoms in a different manner. In cataplexy, you're disassociating from the external, potentially, as you're overwhelmed internally. And mm-hmm. you lose your ability to stay tuned in. You become, the gears of your mind paralyzed. There's a muscle tone of mental thought during cataplexy. But with sleep attacks, which I see as a combination of excessive daytime sleepiness mixing with hypnagogic hallucination and sleep paralysis, there's a different sort of dissociation where you actually, from yourself, you disconnect, you daydream and are in automatic behaviors. So I used that tree example of brain fog. I think that every symptom, there's five core symptoms of narcolepsy, but each one of those symptoms is sort of like that tree. And then think of it like the tree's branches are overlapping, or think of it like there's a web that's all of these symptoms, because the brain fog overlaps with the hypnagogic, well, the excessive daytime sleepiness and the disrupted nighttime sleep. But it's so broad and it's so diverse and expansive. Every individual experiences a different bag, a different part of that tree, and each tree of the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that manner in which the medical realm, or you know, how it's all presented, is so oversimplified that it creates such rampant confusion along with misunderstanding. I mean, there's even division and confliction. It's so hard. And, you know, I was dealing with all of this through my 20s blindly, and it took me about 2 to 3 years as I was trying to get the confirmation. And that whole path, we can start to touch on that.
Right.
The diagnostic path is for so many people, it takes 10 to 20 years or more, or they never get there because they give up, because they go to their doctor and the doctor just decides to sideline or dismiss or downplay or, you know, basically pigeonhole the person coming out of their way, paying them, asking them for help. Mm-hmm. And it's super problematic. I think the U.S. is probably worse than I've listened to some of your shows, and it, you know, I've heard you hit on or talk about there's differences between the UK. I know that in Europe there are actual facilities that focus on narcolepsy. There's expertise. Here in the US, not one specialist of any specific sort is actually trained on narcolepsy. The stat I heard at a Narcolepsy Network conference, again, was that, and this was by medical researchers out of Europe, they said that there are three paragraphs that take less than 5 minutes to read that is the medical required reading material on the entire disease.
Yeah.
And this disease, if you don't have a personal devotion, so in the U.S., you've got neurologists, you've got sleep specialists, pulmonologists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and general practitioners.
Right.
Those are the ones that tend to end up dealing with narcolepsy. But mm-hmm. like I said, not one of them has training in it unless they have a devotion themselves. And furthermore, the way I put it is if you aren't open-minded with a willingness to understand, you're not gonna grasp it. And also you know, and if you don't have that, at least have the courtesy and respect to like hear the patient, you know, because if you come in and you're asking for help with this, you know, I've got sleepiness or I'm dealing with these dreams, or I mean there's so many different directions of it, but getting that dismissed is so disheartening. And
yeah, that's one of the things that I talk a lot about in terms of, you know, sleep in general is a relatively new area that people are focusing on. And the training, like you said, whether it be the MD training, whether it be the PhD, the master's level training, whatever it is, people dealing with issues related to mental health, physical health, they're not really trained about any sleep issues. In school, I know I certainly received zero training about sleep issues. And so the patient comes in and they don't have the frame of reference to understand, you know, maybe they'll think, okay, maybe you have a seizure disorder or something, because that's their only frame of reference.
Depression, that's a big one.
Right, depression, often, yep. So yeah, that's a challenge. And this is where we... one of the purposes of this show is to educate people about this so that you can become your own advocate and bring information with you to your doctor's appointment and say, you know, I wonder if this applies. You know, here's what I found. And that can be really helpful, because if you're not your own advocate, you can easily get sidelined or misdiagnosed.
Great point. Right on point.
So actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to take our second commercial break here, since we're talking about self-advocacy, and then let's get into how you became an advocate. And I know you have some books and some art out there, and I want to make sure we talk about that as well. So we will be right back on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com. www.sleepscience.com. All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Solomon Briggs, and we were just about to start talking about sleep advocacy, being your own advocate, and also the advocacy work that Solomon does, which led him to write some books and do some art. So fill us in.
So as I was dealing with cataplexy, actually, before I had the term, and, you know, it took me, we just talked about how these experiences are so difficult to get acknowledgement and recognition of. Putting them into words is just so hard. And I endlessly, as an advocate and going to conferences, narcolepsy events, attending online webinars and all this and that, interacting with organizations to some extent, just as a volunteer, trying to offer my perspective, I'm asked very often, you know, how can we reach the common person? So on that note, I feel like the diagnostic, clinical, physiological language, you know, medical language and the science I'll include as part of that. It's so valuable and it really does allow for dots to connect. But it's an invisible puzzle until someone individually is able to begin to see the pieces of that puzzle. And like I said, with the whole tree thing, it's so broad and expansive and just complicated that to note and put words onto these things rather than just, you know, you've got like the hypnagogic, hypnopompic hallucinations, which dreams and the whole factor of how narcolepsy is living with a very minimal barrier between your wake and sleep states, you know, the faulty light switch equation, the light can be turned on but flickering and going off or vice versa. Hypnagogic, you're going into REM sleep. You may have euphoric, like actually pleasant, sort of odd, going from reality into a dream, like almost just right when you lay down, but at the same time, or that can be a sleep attack too, I believe, but hypnopompic is coming out of REM, and that is going back in history, recognized to combine with sleep paralysis, and who knows, you know, could it be like a dream is triggering cataplexy and then you're stuck in this paralysis? That's a whole kind of off the wall thing. But the terminology, and like I said at the beginning, you know, muscle weakness being the most common description of cataplexy when you're asking and discussing it, doesn't hit on the actual experience, the human experience. So, you know, I'm trying to bridge that gap. I'm trying to help offer a different way of articulating and even seeing the symptoms. I mean, I go with the medical science. I think it's, like I said, it's so valuable and it is very precise, but at the same time, it's just skipping over, in a sense, the human lived experience. And I don't know how much of that is actually focused upon outside of in surveys or at this point mice and mm-hmm. dogs in labs, you know, for drugs. And like, there's something for me, I really think that, as I sort of put it, for each individual living with this to be able to comprehend it better by beginning to see those pieces of the puzzle, hopefully that can happen through art, through, you know, different ways that these things are articulated. So, mm-hmm.
Well, let me get to this, because I want to make sure we get this in. So we're talking about advocacy, and we're talking about people learning for themselves and then being able to speak with their doctor about what they've learned. And I know that you've written some books. Can you tell us, what are the titles of your books? What are they about? Would they help people in identifying their situation? Let's talk about that for a minute, so we'll make sure we...
In 2012, and what I was going to say about in my 20s, before I even knew the term, I began painting and doing art. I was always an athlete, and I had to... The cataplexy forced me to relearn how to live in every dimension, and I lost so many parts of how I could live before I was 20. Even physically, as an athlete, I had to learn how to be in a very calm zone. After 10 or 15 minutes, I would start having cataplexy while skateboarding from just the physical exertion. So that's another sort of trigger. And I began painting. So around 2012, I had really tried to express through illustrations the cataplexy, because the cataplexy is what altered my life so dramatically. I mean, I can't socialize. I've never had a partner relationship, and that's kind of a choice on my own, because I don't want to overburden, but I also can't be burdened more. It's like so hard to even maintain my own. It took me all through my 20s to begin to be able to find a balance and maintain that balance, and that involved relearning to live. But I did these sketches, and then I decided, because I had started to really look for books and look for other real information on the disease, and all you find is this Hollywood perception that is just so flawed and negative, and like the stigma, the stereotypes, and even just that sleep itself, but the term narcolepsy alone is just, it's life altering, because people do not treat you, see you, respect you the same thereafter. It really is like AIDS or a cancer. I mean, like, I've heard other advocate people, or just people that I've interacted with online. I've been interacting on the message boards and the subreddit and the Discord forever, going back to 2008, just like the medical literature, taking in perspective, taking in others' experiences and stories while offering my own, and going to these conferences. So I put together my first book, and it's art. It's called Expressions of My Own Narcolepsy with Cataplexy. I think it was 2013 that I created it. It's illustrations with descriptions. And I took that book, and I was part of the narcolepsy art exhibit at the Narcolepsy Network conference in Denver. And I remember, even before that, I'd been to a few events and a discussion group with Dr. Mignot, Emmanuel Mignot, who was very critical at the beginning of some of the discoveries. But I asked him a couple very specific questions regarding cataplexy, and his responses were so validating. I mean, his words were something along the lines of, he has patients, you know, he'll be interacting with them, and they'll be in an ongoing state of minimal cataplexy that he can visually see while they have no awareness of it. And that's hitting on the subtle, the drooping, and the speech, and whether or not those people would be able to tune in. So part of the things going back to being able to put the pieces together and actually have something to work with, knowing the range, I created a tool, narcolepsy severity symptom range tool, where there's different descriptions, a minimal, moderate, severe description for every symptom. Now, sleep paralysis is its own thing, and that is generally seen as complete, as I would put it, being like waking up in a complete paralysis. An interesting point is that sleep paralysis and cataplexy involve the exact same mechanism, which is the body's natural mechanism called muscle atonia, which occurs during REM sleep to help prevent one from enacting their dreams physically. So in sleep paralysis, that is lingering into wakefulness upon awakening, where in cataplexy, it's intruding into wakefulness upon stimulation of emotion, or, as I put it in more severe cases, after a point of exertion. And that, I came to that with the research around orexin and just how broad, I mean, the central nervous system is at play, body temperature. Oh man, there's so much. But to try to finish that point up, I believe that the body's energy levels tie to cataplexy in a way that, and also to sleep, in a way that night to night, the ongoing sleep loss / sleep deprivation, that toll is ongoing basically for life. And there's so many psychological and physical impacts of that. We are not able to resync and rebalance the psychological and physical well-being.
Right.
So it's just this brutal ordeal.
Let me interrupt you here just because we only have about a minute left, and I want to make sure that we get the title of your other books. How many books do you have in total?
So in 2000, my second book is Rolling a Path, and it was therapy. All of my books originally were kind of self-therapy, but Rolling a Path, it's about skateboarding, it's about facts on narcolepsy, and lifestyle stuff that I did. And I'm not saying lifestyle stuff is going to cure it, but it overall improving the overall health in healthy manners will benefit the symptoms directly. That's a huge point. My third book is a book of poems, Invisibly Ill, Living the Disunderstanding. All of my books are on Amazon. In 2023, I did some very heavy imagery, like art sketches, and I made a book with those. It's called DIS, but it's got a long title, Raising Awareness Towards Living with Sleep Disorders, a Deep Dive into Living with Severe Cataplexy. There's three sections. First is touching on the six categories of sleep disorders, because I have three sleep disorders. I should have mentioned that at the beginning. An untreatable idiopathic central apnea. I wear a smart pulse oximeter that vibrates when I reach a specific SpO2. And then that helps me wake up and resync my breathing rather than letting it go on. And I have delayed sleep phase onset syndrome, a circadian rhythm disorder. But DIS touches on the six categories, and I go into the different sleep disorders within those. And then the second section is focusing on recognizing the symptoms of narcolepsy. And the third section is a deep dive into living with severe cataplexy, trying to offer some of that lived experience, human perspective, at least, you know, I mean, it's different for everybody, but I think by creating these books, I'm documenting perspective, something, it's at least out there. I just to finish my books, I made a non-imagery version of DIS called Insights and Clarity Towards Sleep Disorders. And that's like a little pocket-sized. That one belongs on the desk of every sleep clinic because it is like, it helps you unlock that invisible puzzle by offering a lot that just is oversimplified, perhaps.
Right. So all of these are on Amazon. So if somebody just looks up your name, Solomon Briggs, Briggs, they would find your books?
I'll also mention I go by Narcoplexic. It's a weird combination of narcolepsy and cataplexy. That is my social media handle. That's my website. That's my Patreon. I'm a photographer, videographer. I enjoy birding and skateboarding and yeah.
Well, you've got a lot to share here, and perhaps we need to do a second episode to follow up on some of these other things. But we are
sure.
A little bit right on our time here. And for those of you listening on the radio, if you want to go to our YouTube channel and watch the video of this, I'll try and put up some of the images and things that we've talked about during this episode so that you can get a better visual cue of those. But Solomon, I want to take this time to thank you so much for taking your time to share your story with us and help spread the word about cataplexy and narcolepsy and just all the things that we want people to be more aware of. And again, that whole idea of being your own advocate is wonderful. So we're seeing a picture of one of his paintings, which you will see on YouTube, and I'll try and give you some other images. But we're out of time for this episode. Thank you for joining us on Sleep Science Today. Go over to our website, www.sleepsciencetoday.com. Sign up for our mailing list, and we'll keep you informed of all future episodes and other special things coming out. Thank you for joining us on today's show.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.